The opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Step outside of your comfort zone. See the world with a whole new perspective. Join us and experience the unexplained on The Paranormal View.
And welcome everybody right here to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us tonight. Beautiful weekend, and I know everybody's doing things in the summer, but those that are here, we're glad that you are here. And those that are listening from around the world, we appreciate each and every one of you also. Got a great show lined up for tonight. So if you do have questions tonight, you can private chat them to Ceiling Cat, or myself, Henry Foister, and we will get those questions, right over and answered for you. And if you're listening from somewhere else, and you, don't want to come over to the chat room, you can still send a question to us to theparanormalview@gmail.com and just put attention question, and, we will get those answered for you. And if you are listening from somewhere else and you'd like to come over and join us here in the chat room and be able to talk with everyone, come on over to paraxradionetwork.com and click on the chat now button up at the top, and you'll be in with all these wonderful people. We've got a lot going on next couple of months. Got a lot of great shows coming up. I'll be going to a couple different places, so and I'll probably be broadcasting from most of them, too. So that ought to be really good. A lot of good people there. With that, let's see. I got, Mid-South coming up? That's in this month, isn't it? And then we got September. We got Fort Mifflin coming up. The Para-X, it's called Ghost and
it's called Horror of the Fort.
That's what it is. And, yeah, that ought to really be good. Going to be a lot of people there from Para-X. So, come out, to that. It's only $45 a ticket, and you'll get to meet all these wonderful people, get to be there all day and wander around the fort and, take some tours. And, then we'll have to have an investigation at night. So, do that. I have with us right now Barbara Duncan.
Howdy.
And I have Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, hello.
And because our guest has a whole lot to talk about, I'm going to let Jeff go ahead and introduce our guest.
Yes, well, our returning guest tonight is author Nick Redfern, whose main area of research, apart from cryptozoology, centers around determining what has been learned about the UFO subject at an official level in Britain. Lecturing on the UFO subject both in the UK and abroad, Nick has been interested in UFOs since 1978 and has spent hundreds of hours at the Public Records Office in London, uncovering thousands of pages of previously classified Royal Air Force, Air Ministry, and Ministry of Defense files on UFOs dating from the Second World War. So welcome back, Nick Redfern.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on again.
Our pleasure, because you got a lot of great stories and a lot of stuff to talk about. And tonight we're going to talk about a little different twist on a UFO that crashed, and it's called the Roswell UFO conspiracy, and we're going to dig into that and see all the other information that you have that can lead you in a different way and throw a different light on the crash. So if people does have questions, feel free to send them right over to Ceiling Cat or myself, and we'll get those answered for you. How did you get started and going in this direction to do the Roswell UFO conspiracy?
Well, you know, as you said in the introduction, I mean, my sort of big area is sort of, you know, government involvement in the UFO subjects. That's when it comes to UFOs, you know, that's sort of the primary area that interests me. And also the whole Men in Black mystery, which I've written three books on. That's my other sort of big interest when it comes to UFOs. But the reason why I do sort of focus on the government angle is because, although I've never had a UFO sighting personally, my dad was in the British Royal Air Force. He was a radar mechanic with the British military. And when you mentioned about 1978, I was sort of like a little kid then, and that's when my dad told me of this encounter that he'd had back in the 50s. And this was at the height of a NATO exercise called Mainbrace. And he was involved when the radar operators late one night were tracking these strange objects approaching the British coastline. And the first thought was, well, it's got to be the Russians, you know, some kind of sneak attack, or at least trying to see what we were doing. Except the objects were flying incredibly high and fast, and at some points literally sort of stopped in midair, you know, came to a sudden halt, which is, you know, impossible for aircraft to do. So fighter planes were sent up to it trying to intercept whatever these things were, and the pilots reported seeing these strange balls of light, and in some cases sort of like classic flying saucer shaped craft. And this went on for 3 nights, and everybody on the fourth day was taken into a room. That's sort of like my father, the, you know, the radar mechanics, the radar operators, the pilots, the ground crew, and everybody was told, you know, you've signed the paperwork to say that you won't talk about what, you know, you learned in the military, etc., etc., you know, if you're exposed to secret material. And I said my dad didn't tell anybody until he told me when I was sort of 10, something like that, maybe. And that sort of really, you know, kind of fascinated me. And then from there, when I sort of, you know, 12, 13, 14, I started reading books by people like Brad Steiger and John Keel. You know, like John Keel, who wrote the Mothman Prophecies book, and Brad Steiger wrote a lot of UFO books in the 60s and 70s, which I was able to sort of, you know, track down old copies and read some of them. So that's sort of how I got on this angle of sort of looking into the whole, you know, government records and government files side of things.
So when you start with Roswell, something I'm sure did crash. The problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, everybody confirmed something came down. It's just, you know, what was it?
Okay. I know in your book, the government, they were putting out stories that it was a weather balloon. And some of the things that points to it in your book, that it was a weather balloon. Why were they trying to tell everybody it was a weather balloon and turn them away from saying that it was a UFO?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the weather balloon angle was an easy one for them to use. I mean, the first news story that came out of a press release from the Roswell Army Air Force Base was that they'd recovered flying disc. Now, it's important to note, you know, this was just 10 days after the first sighting of a flying saucer. So, in other words, nobody really knew what flying saucers or flying discs were. That people were just seeing strange things in the sky. So, you know, today, when we think of flying saucers and UFOs, we think of alien spaceships. But back then, in the summer of 47, you know, there was no UFO history. The Roswell event occurred, as I said, just like 7 days after the first time that the term flying saucer was ever used. So, in other words, you know, flying disc back then was just a mystery. It wasn't sort of until the late 40s, early 50s that people started to think, you know, these are alien spaceships. But I think the angle of saying it was a weather balloon was a convenient one, because, and it certainly worked, because people forgot all about the story. It was big news for like 24 hours. But then when the military said, sorry, we made a mistake, it was just a weather balloon, everybody just said, oh, well, and went back about their business, you know. So, it really did sort of vanish until the late 70s when two researchers, Bill Moore and Stan Friedman, started looking into it and pulled their information together. And then Moore, with Charles Belitz, wrote The Roswell Incident in 1980, which was the first published book on Roswell, and then started to open the doors a little bit more to Roswell, and people then started to go back and look at the original story that died very quickly.
Well, now, to put things in sort of historical perspective here, it was just after World War II. Rockets were becoming a little bit more mainstream.
Yeah.
And the space program was probably very much in the infancy. And so there was a lot of experimental engineering going on at the time.
Yeah, and most of it was actually going on in New Mexico. For example, you made a good point when you said about, the end of the Second World War, because when the war finished, thousands of German scientists, Nazi scientists, were brought over to the U.S. under a program called Operation Paperclip. And if you Google Operation Paperclip, you'll find a lot of material and quite a few of the official files. Again, thousands of pages have been now declassified, but back then, just after we'd defeated the Germans, nobody wanted to admit, that we'd done a deal with them to bring their rocket scientists over. But it was kind of one of those deals that if we didn't do it, then the Russians would have grabbed them. And in a worst-case scenario, if the Russians had them working for them, they could well have developed, rockets far in advance of ours. And in a worst-case scenario, could have launched, an early nuclear attack. And, of course, our defences then, there's no defence against, a nuclear attack. All you can do is fire back. But, if the Russians had got the technology first, then their rocket program could have been well advanced of ours. So, that's why these German scientists were brought over here, partly to advance the U.S. rocket program, but also to prevent the Russians from getting their hands on them. And a lot of weird experiments went on in New Mexico, like places like Alamogordo, at the military base there, at White Sands, where rockets were sent up to the very highest levels of the atmosphere, the stratosphere, just sort of, almost verging on outer space. That's actually how high these rockets went. And, sometimes they would be loaded on board with monkeys and chimpanzees and things like this. And they'd come down and crash, and, people would find these portions of the rockets and the remains of little monkeys lying around on the desert floor. So, you can well understand how some of these stories actually sound very similar to the Roswell story, the idea of strange wreckage being found and small bodies. Well, we can prove in some cases that did happen when, as I said, when it was used, when they were using monkeys and things like that. So, in other words, it's important to, regardless of what you think about Roswell, it is important to note the time frame and the location, New Mexico, and to understand that a lot of weird high-altitude flights with rockets and various sort of alternative aircraft and things like this were taking place right in the area where the crash happened. And ironically, the rancher who found the Roswell wreckage, Mac Brazel, he actually confirmed that this wasn't the first time something had come down on the ranch. He said that on two previous occasions, weather balloons had come down on the ranch itself. And so that may have inspired somebody to say, well, let's just pretend this latest one is a third balloon. But, I think this is one of the things a lot of people forget. It actually is quite significant that when you look at what came down at Roswell, whether it was a UFO or a military device. But the fact is that on that same ranch where that wreckage was found, two previous military devices had already been found by the rancher. So, if we're going to be sort of honest with ourselves, we do sort of need to look at every angle. Was it a UFO, or was it some sort of classified vehicle that, went high up and that had some sort of, a crew on board, if you like?
Well, now, if two had crashed before that was weather balloons, he should have known what the difference was on the third one, because they were saying it was something other than a weather balloon.
Well, yeah, what the big difference is, you know, weather balloons are just extremely small. You know, you could pretty much, you know, you could sort of put it in your on your kitchen floor and roll it up. You know, they weren't big at all. But the Air Force in 1994, well, it wasn't a weather balloon after all. They said it was something called a Mogul balloon. Now, Mogul balloons are actually the same. The materials are the same as weather balloons, but they were strung together. So you had like this huge balloon train, if you like, that extended to about 600 feet. That's literally how large these balloon trains were. And it was a real program. Mogul balloons were used to try and monitor for Soviet atomic bomb tests. They would go high into the atmosphere, and they would have these sensors on them. And as I said, it would be like a 600-foot-long trail of balloons, all with these different sensors, trying to pick up evidence of atomic blasts from Russia. You know, where they were testing them. And so the Air Force said, well, this explains the gigantic field of debris because Mogul balloons were gigantic, you know, balloons. So that theory came from the Air Force in 94, and that is still their official stance on what happened, that no, it wasn't a weather balloon after all, it was a Mogul balloon. But, I mean, but what you're really doing is replacing one balloon for another balloon, but one was just bigger than the other. You know, that's the only difference, really.
Well, now, didn't Japan use big balloons to send bombs over during the Second World War?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they were called Fugo balloons, F-U-G-O. And the Fugo balloons were these quite large balloons, really, which would have bombs attached below them. And Japan would launch them, so they would sort of get into what's called, they go high into the sky and get into what's called the jet stream, which is this sort of, this stream of air which pushes, well, anything that's in the jet stream would sort of, would go towards the United States. And so the idea was that these balloons would sort of, through the jet stream, would be taken towards the US, and they were calibrated to get lower and lower in the sky. And the idea from the Japanese perspective was that these balloons would sort of crash land in the US and explode and kill people. And unfortunately, there were deaths on one occasion, but that was it. But had the Japanese not surrendered when the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese had plans to build even more bigger, massive balloons, which would have crews on board. And if you read the intelligence papers, they talk about how the Japanese planned to fly these gigantic balloons with crews of relatively short guys because, you know, weight, etc., was like a premium. And at the end of the Second World War, in the same way that the German paperclip scientists were brought over, a lot of the blueprints, the technology and the scientists working on these larger Japanese balloons were brought over to try and again integrate that technology into our technology. So, you know, this has given rise to the idea of bigger, much larger, sturdier balloons with new coverings like aluminum plated balloons, very different to the original weather balloons. And looking at the idea, you know, could it actually have been the test of one of these gigantic balloons with these relatively small crews on board that led to the legends of a crashed UFO and small aliens? Or, you know, was one a cover story for the other? You know, we just don't know. But I think the important thing is, as I point out in the book, is, you know, we should be impartial and not kind of be stuck in that I want to believe factor, you know. I mean, right. Whatever happened at Roswell, it's the most important case because the stakes are so high. If it's proved to be extraterrestrial or it's shown not to be extraterrestrial, it's still, you know, it's still ufology's number one case.
Right. Brings it to light.
And ironically, yeah. Since you use the I want to believe term, there was an entire episode on the X-Files explaining Operation Paperclip.
Mm.
So I first heard that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the first time I'd heard of it, and now every time I hear it, I'm like, I know about that.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of the scientists, you know, as I said, a lot of people in government were not happy about bringing the German scientists over because, you know, these were military guys who you know, we just defeated them in the Second World War, and now we're having to do deals with them. And a lot of people in both the government and the intelligence community and also the military were not happy with sort of doing deals with Nazis. They felt that this was the wrong approach to take. But then when it was shown to them, well, if we don't bring them over here, the Russians are going to march straight into, you know, what's left of Germany after the war and just grab these guys. And if they take them back to Russia, they're going to develop their rockets before us. So it was almost like doing a deal with the devil because you had no choice, you know, because, like I said, the other side, the Russians would have got them. So it was like a reluctant deal, which, you know, is totally understandable that nobody would really want to do this, but it was a case of if it's not us, it's them who gets them, you know.
Well, that brings up, you know, the early Air Force and as the precursor to NASA, because all the astronauts were at that point pilots. The space race then pretty much was more than likely just high air reconnaissance to begin with, and not so much a lunar or other planet exploration.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the space race itself didn't really begin until 1957. That was when the Russians launched Sputnik 1, which was the first vehicle to actually go into outer space. You know, that was the very first one, and it kind of sent shockwaves around the world, you know, that the Russians had got there first, and, you know, no one was happy about that at all. And, of course, you know, the Russians got the first animals in space, they got the first man in space, first woman in space. So, you know, we really needed to sort of stay on top of things because there was that point when they were, you know, significantly ahead of us, which was, you know, at the height of the Cold War. This was not a good thing. But certainly before 57, the high altitude flights would sort of go, as I said earlier, it's at the highest point of the atmosphere to where you're reaching what's called the stratosphere. And, you know, this was sort of going as high as you could without literally going into space. And that's back then, there was not much understanding of what the effects would be from extreme high altitudes, oxygen deprivation, exposure to cosmic rays and things like this. So that's why experiments were undertaken with animals. But, you know, unfortunately for the animals, I mean, a lot of their, you know, physical makeup is different to ours. So you wouldn't necessarily get a perfect answer, you know, because, I mean, physically and physiology-wise, you know, a chimpanzee is quite different to our bodies, you know, they're very different. So you would only get sort of a vague comparison if you sent animals high up and then when they came down, you know, you would see how they've been affected or not affected. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is sort of early secret programs that involved people, if you like, guinea pig crews or people, not so much necessarily a crew that actually piloted them, but taken on board these giant balloons and then assessed when they came back down to see how they'd survived or didn't survive or if they were badly affected by, you know, exposure to the rigors of high altitudes. So we know all this was going on. The big question, of course, was something of a UFO nature going on in the same area as well, and that's, you know, where it gets complicated. Is it one thing or another, or is it a little bit of both, you know?
Now, when you started, go ahead, Barbara.
Oh, I was just going to ask if the possibility was that there were covert Russian or other, maybe Chinese even, experiments that were going on at the same point that would have crashed.
Well, that's an interesting theory. You know, I mean, one of the alternative angles that's been put forward for Roswell is that it was some sort of like a Russian spy plane that came down and, you know, that we hid it because, again, you know, they were maybe had their technology could have been a little bit more advanced. You know, but the problem is with Roswell, there are so many different theories. I mean, as I said, the Air Force first said it was a flying disc, then said it was a weather balloon. Now they say it was a Mogul balloon. You have the Soviet spy plane angle. You have the idea that some people talk about, you know, sort of more extreme theories, like could they have been time travelers from the future? That kind of thing. Come back to see what happened at Roswell, and then they crash and they end up being the, you know, the craft of the bodies from Roswell. Which is kind of an interesting little theory, you know.
Philosophically, that's called the bootstrap principle.
Yes, yeah. But it is, you know, it's kind of a fascinating little theory as well. And then there's also people who, you know, suggest that, you know, could it have been like an atomic bomb was mistakenly dropped and which fortunately didn't explode, you know, actually sort of fell out of the bomb bay of an aircraft or something. And, you know, there are multiple theories, but the problem is for every theory, there's no paperwork. I mean, even the Air Force admitted with their theory that it was one of these giant Mogul balloons, they said, well, we think that's what it is, but we've gone looking and we cannot find any documents to actually support that theory. They couldn't find any documents to show that a Mogul balloon came down on the ranch. On the other hand, they couldn't find any documents to say that even a weather balloon came down or a UFO or anything. They just said, we've gone looking and we just cannot find any files. So, and that's the big problem we kind of all face with Roswell, is that there's just a total lack of any kind of official documentation. And I think it's got to be somewhere. But with the Air Force, you know, a lot of people painted the Air Force as the bad guys for hiding all this. But I actually don't think the Air Force is hiding anything. I don't view the Air Force or the government even as the bad guys hiding the truth about Roswell. What I think is that it's more likely that there's sort of like a what are called black budget programs, like a secret government buried deeply within the real government, which it operates outside of the regular confines of law, which isn't overseen by Congress, and Congress probably doesn't even know about it. And these things are known as special access programs, SAPs, where even if you have a top secret clearance, if you're not working on this particular program, you will not be told about it. So when the Air Force went looking and said they couldn't find anything, I do believe them. But somebody knows something. Something's been hidden. But I think these special access programs, because they're so incredibly deeply hidden and so sort of powerful, etc., that even the Air Force of today, I don't think, actually knows what happened at Roswell, which kind of sounds a bit strange until you kind of get your head around the idea that it's all been overseen and hidden by a group within the government that is buried so deep that even the government itself isn't aware of it now today.
I almost thought you were going with the idea that somehow the paperwork may have just fallen through the cracks and got destroyed either deliberately or accidentally, and they're like, we just can't find it.
Well, I seriously don't think it would have been destroyed by mistake, but if it was, you know, if it was a UFO, if it was an alien spaceship, that documentation would never be destroyed because, you know, studies of the wreckage and the bodies, that would be unique material and that documentation would be kept forever. But if it was a secret experiment that went wrong and, you know, they said, well, we didn't really learn much and we're a bit concerned, you know, because we're using German and Japanese scientists, I can easily understand under those circumstances where they may well have destroyed all the documents, you know, to protect the truth of what happened, because it was kind of like, you know, it would have been perceived as a controversial, slightly embarrassing experiment, you know, to admit that we were using Japanese or German people or whatever in these experiments. So under those circumstances, I can see why the documents would be destroyed. But if it was a UFO, you know, an alien spaceship, that would never be destroyed. That would still have to be, you know, hidden away somewhere because of the value of trying to understand, you know, what a UFO actually is.
Now, when you started digging and everything to make this book, one of the chapters you had was whistleblowers. When you found different people that was actually going to talk, what did they have to say about Roswell?
Well, yeah, I mean, here's where it gets controversial because, you know, people like Kevin Randall, Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, who are sort of on the pro-ET angle of Roswell, you know, they've got their military sources, elderly guys and women who said they were sure that what came down was an alien spacecraft. And then, you know, the people who I interviewed for my book, again, sort of elderly men and women, you know, in their late 70s and early 80s, or late 80s when I interviewed them, they said, well, no, the UFO angle is a cover for these military experiments. So, in other words, you know, it's difficult to know whose truth is the real truth and whose lie is the truth or whatever, you know.
Or misperception.
Well, misperception could be an angle. And also, you know, the whole angle of what's called disinformation, where if you want to hide something and the story is already out there and you're not able to hide it, the next best thing to do is to try and confuse it. In other words, the reason we know about the Roswell case is, regardless of what came down, the rancher, Mac Brazel, because it was on his property, on this gigantic ranch, he got there before the military, and then he told his local neighbors, and they came out to see this strange wreckage, and then he called the sheriff's, went to the sheriff's office, and then from there, the sheriff's office called the Roswell base and said, hey, you know, this rancher in Lincoln County's found this strange material, you really ought to come out and see it. So, in other words, in a worst-case scenario for the government, the public, the rancher got there first, and, you know, so the story got out to the press. So, in other words, the story was out before the government could do anything about it, which may explain, you know, when it comes to disinformation, why so many alternative theories are being put out there. You know, if you can't hide it, then confuse it. And I think that's probably what's happened over the years and why we have multiple theories. And among those multiple theories, one of them has to probably be the real one. But the problem is, it's which one is the real one, you know.
Which one's the real one, right?
Yeah.
Well, it would seem to me that the complete absence of evidence is evidence in itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point because, I mean, even the Air Force admitted that when they went looking for the files on Roswell, although they didn't find anything documentation-wise, what they did find was actually quite intriguing. And what they did find was that all of the outgoing messages from Roswell, the military base, from 45 to 51, all the outgoing messages are gone. And when I say gone, I mean they're just nowhere. They're not at the National Archives. They're not in the archives of the old Roswell base. They're not anywhere. They just cannot be found. So either they were destroyed or they exist somewhere within this special access program that's, you know, maybe kind of just storing them in some kind of almost like a, you know, sort of a museum or something along those lines. But, and again, this is why I don't think the Air Force was lying, because if the Air Force really knew what happened, today's Air Force, I don't think they would have admitted that, well, hang on, all the files have gone. I think they would have kept quiet on that, but they didn't. To their credit, they actually said, well, all the files are gone from 45 to 51, and we don't know what happened to them. That doesn't sound like a cover-up. That actually sounds like the Air Force were as baffled as we are, and I think they were. Now, of course, the big question I point out in the book, well, if Roswell was just a UFO event out of the blue in the summer of 47, why the need to pull files from 45, 46... 48, 49, 50, and 51. If it was a series of ongoing secret experiments, as I was told, human experiments, that might explain why, you know, the files from 45 to 51 were pulled, because the experiments were going on in that time. But you could also make a case, well, if it was a UFO event, somebody was just being extremely careful and just decided to grab all the files in case something had been put in the wrong order, you know, the wrong filing cabinet. Because back then, you know, there were no Word documents, you know, no online files. It was just paper and those weird old things known as typewriters, you know. So, you know, you could also make an argument that somebody decided to pull everything. you know, just in the hope that nothing got left behind. But that is that's a verifiable fact, that every single outgoing message from the base from 45 to 51 is literally gone. It just cannot be found.
Now, is that base still in operation, or has it been closed?
Well, it's not so much closed. What it is now, there's the Roswell Airport. It's just a small airport where, you know, people flying in, members of the public, I mean, you know, American Airlines flies into there with little shuttle planes, and, you know, you want to go to see Roswell, and, you know, you want to go see the museum and the sites and the crash sites or whatever. You know, if you, let's say you live hypothetically in New York, you know, you fly from New York to Albuquerque, then from Albuquerque you get a little shuttle to Roswell, and the airport itself, it actually has a cool little museum in there that tells you all about the history of the base and how it was established. But interestingly enough, there's absolutely nothing about the Roswell incident itself in the museum at the airport. And the old hangar where the bodies and the wreckage were supposedly taken, that's actually still there. I mean, it's been sort of renovated over the years, but the old hangars have now been sort of leased out to companies, you know, engineering companies, things like this. And so, in other words, it's not a military base anymore. But the huge runway, obviously, I mean, the runway's not that big, I should say, but that's where the planes land. But the area where you used to have, where it was the military base, where all the planes were kept, it's actually a storage area now for old passenger planes. Let's say, for example, you know, you've got like a 737 aircraft that needs new tires or, you know, wing flaps or something like that. The Roswell base actually is one of the main areas in the U.S. where a lot of passenger planes that have been gone past their age, you know, they're all stored there. You can, you know, when you land, you see them. There's like 300 passenger planes there, you know, big ones like 737s. And it's kind of like a aircraft graveyard, and as you'll see if you ever land there, you'll see all the engines are missing and the tires are missing off the planes, you know, and the windows are missing. And it's because, as I said, if a plane needs new parts or, you know, replacement parts, they go there and then pull them off all the old planes which are stored at Roswell. So it's got kind of like even a sort of a cool history today, you know, never mind in the past as well.
Well, I've been there in southern Arizona. There's Sierra Vista, and they have what they call the Boneyard, which is also a large section where old, out-of-commission planes have been stored. And it's just really weird to just see them like in a – it's like they're in a big parking lot. It looks really kind of weird.
Well, it's kind of, when you say old planes, it's almost like, you know, you're in something like The Walking Dead. You know, there's been like some – apocalypse, you know, and everybody's gone, you know, and there's just these old planes just silently sitting out there in the desert, you know.
Everyone's gone to the moon, yeah.
So I'm kind of surprised they don't at least play up the Roswell incident at a Roswell museum with, like, the headline and newspaper and all that. And
there is a UFO museum in town, but the one I'm talking about is the museum at the airport itself, you know, when you land and clear security, etc. But, I mean, it's not a big museum, it's just like a couple of rooms, but they've got sort of cool old uniforms that the men and the women used to wear, and, you know, they've got mannequins dressed up, and a lot of really good photographs from the time, you know, of the era and what it looked like. But certainly in Roswell, the town, you know, they definitely, you know, have sort of, you know, Roswell, the case has worked well for them. I was actually out there last weekend for the 70th anniversary conferences. I was speaking out there, and I think round about 15,000 people came into town from out of town. And, of course, you know, everybody in the town itself likes to come out and support it. And Roswell itself has what's called Main Street. It's called Main Street because it's sort of the main street through Roswell. It's actually, I would say, I don't know, 9 or 10 miles long, maybe a little bit longer. And, you know, there's the UFO Museum, which is really cool place to go and see. They've got sort of, you know, life-size replications of the bodies. And there's, like, one part where there's mannequins dressed up as doctors and they're sort of autopsying the bodies and They've got models and photographs and all sorts of stuff there. So it's, you know, you can buy things like T-shirts, you know, and fridge magnets, and but all up and down, you know, the main street of Roswell, you know, there are restaurants selling alien burgers and ET burritos, you know, and you can get like extraterrestrial soda, and just about every company, you know, promotes the UFO angle. There's an insurance company in town which has like a big model of a UFO over the building. So you know, everybody gets into it, and it's sort of, you know, it's the weekend of the, you know, the celebrations. I mean, obviously a lot of it is about people giving lectures and trying to figure out what happened at Roswell, but it's also, you know, a big celebration for the town, you know, where people come along, the families and the kids, and they can get to learn about the incidents and, you know, watch movies and old film footage, and you know, that you can't actually go to the crash site. A lot of people don't realize how far the crash site is from Roswell itself. It's not even in the same county. The crash site is in what's called Lincoln County. And the only reason why Roswell is actually tied to the case is because when the wreckage was found, the nearest base that could come out and respond was the Roswell base. But it actually takes about 90 minutes to drive from Roswell to the crash site. So it's, you know, it's quite a drive, really, maybe a little bit more than that. But you know, Roswell has done well, and they've promoted it in kind of like a cool, entertaining way, but also informative too.
Wow. Did we lose somebody?
Not me.
Oh, okay. Just got too quiet. I got a question from the chat room, but I think we'll wait till right after break, because it's already past break time. So we're going to take a quick little break, about, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes, so you can run and get something to drink or whatever you might have to do. Just remember, the mics are live, so don't go cussing us out.
I'll try not to.
Jeff, you going to take us out and I'll bring us back. How's that sound? Oh, Jeff ain't here.
I think Jeff probably got kicked off. So, folks, you're listening to The Paranormal View here on Para X Radio with our very special guest, Nick Redfern, talking about UFOs in Roswell. We will be right back after a few messages.
In order for the light to shine so brightly, the darkness must be present. Tune in every Monday at 10 o'clock for Dark Sun Rising on the Para-X Radio Network.
Are you psychic? Do you often have dreams that come true? Do you have an interest in hypnosis or astrology? If you'd like to learn more about classes, events, and books on metaphysics, then go to our website, www.theartofmediumship. This is Elaine Kosmaskis, director of the New England School of Metaphysics and author of The Art of Mediumship.
Hi, this is Master Tarot Card Reader Ken Bogle, and I highly encourage you to tune in every Monday night to the Para-X Radio Network for The Paracave, hosted by Matt Gesso, as he goes in search of the truth in the supernatural, metaphysical, mystic, and paranormal. Monday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern, only on the Para-X Radio Network. I never miss it, and neither should you.
Hi, I am John Zaffis, and you are listening to Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hey there. I don't know if you've heard, but there's a great new radio show on Para-X. 2 hosts, 1 hour, and too much fun. Stephanie and Heidi not only talk about the latest goings-on in the supernatural worlds, they live it. They want to hear from you. They want to help you understand and guide you. And they want you to tune in. So, grab a friend or come alone to gather around that metaphysical table with Heidi and Stephanie. If you're interested in the worlds of the unseen, tune in to The Gathering Radio Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Para-X Radio.
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking time to be with us tonight, those listening in the chat room and those listening from around the world. We appreciate each and every one of you. I believe we lost Jeff. I'm sure he's trying to get rebooted. We still have Barbara with us.
I am here.
Speaking of listening from around the world, where do we have listeners from?
Tonight they're listening from all over the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, and unknown.
All right. Well, welcome back, Nick Redfern.
Hi, guys.
All right. Looks like Jeff's back. I'm going to go ahead and add him to the call now also. That was sneaky. He got out of having to take us out, didn't he?
Yeah.
And I guess now that he's going to be back on, that he'll have another 2 or 3 months of having to do it, right?
No, all of a sudden I got this notice. Skype says, no microphone detected. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And then the minute I could hear you guys, and I'm like, well, let me just unplug the mic, put it back in, and then you started saying to take me out. I'm like, can you hear me? And I realized, oh, they can't.
Well, like I said, we got a question from the chat room. It's from Tabby, and she wanted to know what your theory is to why the U.S. government hasn't finally admitted that we have been in contact with ETs?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there could be sort of, you know, various explanations. I mean, one would be, you know, if we've got alien technology, then we wouldn't want it to fall into the hands of, you know, like North Korea. I mean, you only have to look at the way things are right now with them sort of, you know, trying to develop an intercontinental missile. You know, if he got his hands on alien technology, who knows what the outcome would be. So I think that's part of the reason, you know, the fear that if we understand alien technology and it got into the hands of people who might use it against us, you know, that'd be a good reason to sort of hide it. There's also, you know, the economic issue. For example, I mean, if you look at the world today, one of the major areas of income, you know, for a lot of nations is oil. You know, everything is reliant on oil. Well, let's say, you know, we've understood the alien technology and it could do away with our need for oil. Well, that could actually, by suddenly turning around and saying that, you know, we don't need your oil anymore, ever, you know, you would have massive breakdowns around the world, with, you know, entire nations relying on oil for their income. You know, they would collapse, and you'd have sort of, you know, social collapse across, you know, much of the Middle East and elsewhere, and it could destabilize, you know, much of the planet. Yeah. So I think there's also economic reasons like that. I don't think it's just they don't want to tell us. And I think also, you know, again, I don't view the people who hide in the truth of the UFO subject as bad guys. I mean, I'm sure they're just like us, you know, they go to work and, you know, but also, you know, they cook up with their friends, you know, they take the kids to school, but they're sitting on this big secret that they're not sure how to handle or what to do with it. You know, they're not sort of like villains with, you know, black mustaches they're twiddly, you know, and manipulating people. They're just, like I said, normal people, but with an extraordinary job and a big burden as to what they should do with this material. Should they tell people or should they keep it hidden? So I think, you know, these are all reasons why the story hasn't come out. And also, the one reason which I think a lot of people don't think about is that the government, you know, maybe the government does have crashed UFOs and bodies, but if they've got no answers as to what these things are or where they're from or what they want, that would be a good reason not to tell us, because everybody thinks, you know, well, if the government has got secret files on UFOs, that means they know what's going on and where these things are from and they've got a handle on everything. But it may really be that, yes, the government's hiding everything they've got, but after 70 years, they still don't know what's going on or what the agenda is or where these things are from. For a lot of people, that would be more scary than the government saying, we do know what's going on. You know, so it might be the reason they haven't told us is because they haven't got a clue what's going on, only the fact that something is going on.
Okay, speaking of bodies, and we look at, well, all the really strange videos of alien autopsies, et cetera, et cetera. In your mind, if you deconstruct these alien graves, for example, which did come first, the bodies or the body type? Where did we get the idea of these little green gray men with black eyes, etc.?
Well, I mean, that's a good question too, because when the whole UFO subject kicked off in the summer of 47, I mean, people were talking about seeing strange things in the sky. They weren't talking about people, you know, seeing crews and or whatever you want to term them, spacemen, astronauts. You know, nobody was talking about that. It was just things in the sky. Then in the early 50s, you had the rise of what was called the contactee movement, which was people who claimed to have been in contact with very human-looking aliens, people like George Adamski, Truman Bethlehem, George Van Tassel, Dana Howard. These were all people who claimed that they met these sort of long-haired, very human-looking aliens, very often in desert locations, and they claimed that they wanted us to lay down our nuclear weapons and all live in peace with each other. And they encouraged these people to sort of go out and spread the word and write books and hold conferences, that kind of thing. But as I said, they were described as looking very human-like. Then in 61, you had the abduction experience of Betty and Barney Hill driving home from vacation in Canada and back to their New Hampshire home. And they had this weird experience of missing time and memories and nightmares of being taken on board some sort of device and experimented on, etc., etc. But the Hills aliens didn't look, you know, kind of like what we talk about today. They were sort of about 5 feet tall, and they had dark eyes, big eyes, but they weren't sort of the classic little greys. The so-called greys that people talk about today, these little 3 foot tall, almost insect-like creatures with big black eyes and large, you know, hairless heads, etc. They really didn't come onto the scene until sort of the early 70s, and certainly more so in the late 70s and definitely through the 80s. So there's been sort of a change in what people have described over the years, you know, which has led some people to believe that there are sort of multiple races visiting the Earth, and that some of them could be more human than others. Some people think that the greys could actually almost be like a biological robot created just to perform specific tasks. You know, we think of robots, we think of kind of clunky things, you know, moving around jerkily, etc., etc. But, you know, when you're talking about like a biological robot, you're talking about something literally that in a way is alive, but it's biologically created rather than built. And, you know, if you could sort of program its mind just to perform one specific task, you know, like an abduction program, you know, they would almost be the equivalent of kind of like worker ants, you know, in ant nests where you have, you know, different ants have different roles. You know, some of the workers building the nests, others guard the nests, you know, others guard the queen ants. You know, they have ants actually have sort of really rigid, highly structured societies. One of the theories is parallels that with the greys, the idea that, you know, there are certain greys who perform this task or that task, and they do it sort of, you know, like in a, almost like a programmed fashion, you know, that they may not actually be independent creatures like us, you know, that they might be sort of biologically created to essentially run the programs.
Yeah.
So were the greys actually described in the Roswell crash, or were there any indications of bodies, and were they described as greys?
Well, interesting enough, they actually weren't. Most of the people who talked about the bodies described them as being not unlike humans. For example, one of the people who we know was out at the crash site was a man named Melvin Brown, and we know for sure he was at the base because his photograph appears in the 1947 yearbook from the military base. And he actually said that the bodies he saw could have passed for Chinese people. He said their eyes were sort of elongated and slanted, and they had sort of like a Chinese quality to them, which, you know, but there was no talk of them being solid black. Nobody described the bodies, you know, as having been solid black eyes like the greys today. So that's why you have some people who think we're dealing with aliens at the crash site. Other people think it was people. But for the most part, witnesses describe seeing bodies round about 5 feet tall, human-like, but not the greys. You know, it's kind of ironic because if you, you know, Google any artwork on Roswell, you know, you often see pictures of the, you know, the wrecked UFO and the bodies laying around, and artists always draw the bodies as looking like the greys, but that's not actually what the witnesses described. You know, it's just become part of, it's been kind of accepted by ufology that they were the greys, but when you read the witness reports, they actually weren't, you know.
Well, it sort of falls into the line of all the artists who draw what we call the white Jesus. It's like, oh, they all look like Jeffrey Hunter. But wasn't there, when they were bringing troops out to remove debris and the bodies, wasn't the local funeral home notified and asked to bring child-sized coffins?
Yeah, that's right. What happened was, there's this story that, to sort of backtrack, what happened was we had the rancher, Mac Brazel, who ran the Foster Ranch. And I mean, the ranch is gigantic. I went out there about 7 years ago. And I mean, it's a huge area of land. And he found this field of debris, which sort of fanned out in this one particular area of the ranch for about 500 feet. It's a pretty large area where this stuff, it just looked like foil that had rained down on the ranch. Now, he didn't know what it was, but he reportedly, when he, you know, he contacted the sheriff and then just went on about his work. Now, there's a story, or actually several stories, that roughly 2 miles from that debris site when he was working the fields and, you know, doing his daily work, that he stumbled on one or more of the bodies as if they'd been sort of blown out at a high level in the sky, and, you know, they'd come down at a different place to where the this whatever thing had exploded, balloon or a UFO, and showered the material down, but the, you know, the beings on board or the people on board were blasted out and came down sort of 2 miles away. And then there's a story of a semi-intact vehicle of some sort being found at a third site. So when the military went out there and found the wreckage, essentially what happened is that the rancher, Matt Brazel, said, well, yeah, this is interesting, you know, all this strange material, this foil, but there's something else I've got to tell you about. And the military is like, well, what? And he said, well, you better come and see for yourself. And he took them out to this area where there were these sort of rotting, decaying bodies which had been laying out in the heat of the, you know, New Mexico summer sun for 2 days. And so then reportedly this emergency plan was put into place to try and preserve the bodies, which didn't apparently work too well because they were already in a state of sort of significant decay. And there's several sort of controversial stories about small caskets or coffins being asked for, or if anybody at the, you know, knew any way to preserve these things. And by all accounts, that some sort of preservation of the bodies was achieved briefly, and they were quickly flown to what today is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, which is the home of what's called the Foreign Technology Division, where they anything that's sort of foreign to the U.S. and that we get our hands on, it goes there to be studied. And the story is, you know, that the bodies were preserved in, you know, chemicals, that kind of thing, to try and prevent them from sort of degrading anymore, you know.
It reminds me of the saying, when legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll never know. Yeah. I mean, because, I mean, these stories about, you know, the small coffins, etc., that story primarily came from a guy named Glenn Dennis, who actually did work at what was called the Ballard Funeral Home back then. The Ballard Funeral Home is still there. It still exists, and it's still a funeral home in town. But there are, you know, there are as many people who believe Dennis's story as there are people who don't believe it. So, you know, it's like a lot of these old stories surrounding Roswell that, you know, there are people who believe the story and the people who don't believe them. And again, you know, the problem for us is to try and figure out, again, like I said, whose truth is the truth. And then try and, you know, just keep pushing further and harder to try and get information and data, you know, that might help us answer exactly what happened. But I guess the problem for everybody is that, you know, we're talking about an event that actually occurred 70 years ago. And, you know, if you put that into perspective, let's say you had like a 21-year-old guard out at the crash site. Well, that 21-year-old guard today would be 91. You know, when you look at it like that, you realize how far, you know, how long ago this all was. And I think that's why it's becoming more and more difficult to solve it, because just about anybody who is involved now is dead. You know, there's barely one or two left. You know, like I said, if you were 20, then you'd be 90 now. If you were 30, you'd be 100. So there really isn't hardly anybody left. And, of course, in a couple of years, there won't be anyone left who was involved. And then, of course, we're really facing an uphill battle when we're trying to figure out what happened, when there's literally no one else who is involved to talk to anymore, that every single one is gone. Then it will become difficult, you know, and the only real way we could get the answers then would be something like if disclosure occurred, or, you know, if there was something along, I don't think this would happen, but if there was something like a ufological Edward Snowden kind of situation, you know, regardless of what people think of Snowden, whether some people, you know, view him as a traitor, some people view him as a hero, a lot of people are somewhere in between. You know, if something like that happened, I don't think that would happen, because the reason why Snowden got all that material out was because it all digitized. You know, you're able to get it on a flash drive or whatever. Back then, it would all be paperwork. You know, nobody could walk out of a classified room, you know, with 10 feet piles high of paperwork. It just wouldn't be feasible. So I don't think that would ever happen. So I think either if the answers to Roswell come, it'll either be through disclosure, or I think the more likely possibility could be if something gets declassified by mistake. And that actually does happen, even with the Freedom of Information Act, where material documents that are actually classified and they're coming up for declassification, the government says, well, we can't release this, or we're going to have to censor it because it contains information that still could have an effect on national security. Sometimes documents do get released by mistake, and if one document got released by mistake and it actually referenced the crash, then that could actually open the door to, you know, press for more information, and then the whole kind of house of cards could come tumbling down. But I mean, whether that will happen or whether it'll just be, you know, an ongoing mystery, you know, it's hard to say, really.
Wow.
But if that is a dark government secret and all the paperwork has disappeared,
yeah,
the likelihood of any mistaking released forms is probably not very good.
No, I mean, I talk about that in the book, the idea that if it was a secret experiment and everything was destroyed, it will just become like a legend, which cannot be proved either way because nothing's left. The only chance, well, not the only chance, but the biggest chance we have to solving it is if it was extraterrestrial, because all those files and old photographs would be so unique, they would still be needed today. If it was a secret experiment, I do actually wonder if they would have managed to successfully destroy every single page of every document spread across all these various installations that was, you know, working on these things. And, you know, who knows, maybe some old guy who's like 98 now, you know, when he was 28, maybe even took some of the documents and they're sitting in his attic somewhere in a box, just waiting for someone, or waiting for the day when he decides to release them. You know, it's seldom the case, very rarely the case that, you know, things happen perfectly 100% exactly as somebody wants them to go. So it wouldn't surprise me, you know, if there were some stashes of documents somewhere that the government thinks it's got everything, but it may actually not have everything.
Well, if there is a deep, dark second government, they've probably got everything so far hid that nobody in the regular government even knows about it. So,
yeah, and I mean, also, there's the physical location. I mean, if whether it was a UFO or it was a man-made experiment, all of that material and the bodies, you know, the photographs, all the autopsy reports, which would have been done regardless of whether it was ours or somebody else's. I mean, the chances are all that material is either going to be stored out at somewhere like Area 51, which no one can get into, or, you know, it's going to be stored under a particular Air Force base, maybe 50 feet underground, you know, concrete bunker, which is guarded 24/7, you know, massive vault doors, like, you know, bank vault doors, that kind of thing. Just no one would be able to access it unless you were part of the program. So, you know, again, it's just the physical logistics as well make it kind of almost impossible to get this, you know, material.
It's stashed right next to the Ark of the Covenant in some warehouse somewhere.
Probably.
Yeah, well, kind of like you're talking about the final stages of the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie,
yeah,
where, you know, the government finally gets its hands on the Ark of the Covenant, but because they don't understand the technology, instead of having this huge program investigating it, they just put it, they lock it away in a warehouse and do nothing with it. And ironically, doing nothing with it and not bringing people into the program actually makes it much easier to hide the secret. You know, if you open it up and invite 1,000 scientists to work on it, one of them is going to talk. But if you just store it away and do nothing with it, then that actually is a really good way to hide it, is by doing absolutely nothing with it at all.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Because
I was going to ask you if you think with today's technology, Google Earth, etc., could another Roswell incident ever be a problem?
Well, that's an interesting, you know, idea or theory. I mean, everybody's, you know, got an iPhone, or most people have got an iPhone, you know. I think actually would be, it would be difficult today to prevent people from getting some sort of evidence. I mean, if something came down, you know, in the desert today, well, there's going to be people who get out there and, you know, running around with their iPhone and getting pictures and uploading them immediately. You know, it's not like even the old days where somebody's camera could just be confiscated, or they just pull the reel of film out of the back of the camera and hold it up to the light and expose it. It's not like that now. You know, even if your iPhone's confiscated, you know, if you're at the crash site, well, if you've already uploaded a bunch of pictures to Facebook or, you know, to YouTube or whatever, then the cat's out the bag. So I think today the situation would have been very different to what it was back in 47, and I think it would be tougher today to, you know, to hide all the data. I mean, it's kind of like the situation where, you remember about, I think it was like 2003, 2004, it was when the second space shuttle explosion happened, you know, it rained down all this wreckage in Texas. You know, there were people who found it on their property and photographed it, and the military came out and picked it up, but they'd already, you know, posted pictures of it and the story was out. So, yeah, it would be very difficult to do it today, you know, as they did back then. I mean, the Foster Ranch, where the wreckage was found back in 47, is extremely isolated. I mean, you cannot drive onto it in a car. You know, destroy your suspension and everything. You know, you need like an all-terrain vehicle. It's up and down and bouncing and, you know, I won't even call it roads, you know, it's just sort of like hilly ground. And it's private property as it was then. And it's in the middle of nowhere. And so, in other words, back then, it would have been easy to secure the site and have nobody know, because even for the rancher, you know, his nearest neighbors were like 2 miles away. So, but that's very different. You know, the world's a different place now. So.
Well, I find it interesting that the reports of actually an alien craft crash are very, very rare. So either they've gotten really good at driving, or they have alien AAA, or there was no crash of an alien ship that we're aware of.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at it like that, or you can look at it from the perspective of some people say that, well, you know, if they are so highly advanced, maybe their things would rarely ever crash. But, I mean, nothing is, you know, completely infallible. You know, there's going to be accidents, whether, you know, I mean, you look at aircraft, you know, the most advanced aircraft, unfortunately, they do crash now and again. Like cars, you know, there's always, you know, you could look at any kind of technology, and no matter how advanced it is, occasionally things go wrong, or occasionally, you know, something will crash. And so I guess you could make the same argument with UFOs. You know, their technology could be, you know, massively in front of ours in terms of how advanced they are. But even they, you know, may not be completely like, you know, Superman, where they've got everything covered. So you could make an argument that, you know, out of every 10,000 sightings, one crashes. I mean, we don't really know, but it is interesting that, you know, most of the crash stories we get are from sort of the 40s and 50s, when, you know, why that should be. I mean, if they were sort of classified military programs, that would explain it. Why aliens would crash so much in the 40s and 50s, but not now, you know, that's sort of a difficult question to answer. But, you know, we're not getting a lot of reports of UFOs sort of crashing in New Mexico and Arizona, etc. now, but there are a lot of legends and stories like that from the 40s and 50s. So, you know, we have to kind of ask, you know, why that should be the case. You know, we don't really have the answer.
We have got a ton more questions. And our time just seems to be running right on by. I think we want to take just a quick break, maybe 2.5-3 minutes, and we'll come back and get started on these. I even need probably 3 hours tonight, but that's the way it goes. I do want to remind everybody that if you do have questions, you can private chat them to either Ceiling Cat or myself, and we will get those questions answered for you. With that, Jeff, you get to take us out, and we will be back shortly.
Cool. You're listening to The Paranormal View on ParaxRadioNetwork.com with host Henry Foister, Ceiling Cat Bar Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, and tonight's office awesome guest, returning prolific author, cryptozoologist, and ufologist Nick Redfern. So stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Para-X Radio. Programming for the open mind.
I found it at last! Marla's sacred cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron.
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going.
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
My name is Greg Bakken. I'm a writer, a producer, and a paranormal investigator. My favorite way of communicating with spirits is through using the Spirit Box, also known as a Ghost Box. I invite you to listen to me every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Central for interviews with people in the paranormal community and beyond. Plus, I will also include as much of my Spirit Box evidence as I can during my show.
My name is Greg. Can you say Greg? Can you say Jeff?
Great. Jeff.
Join me every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Central Time for Minnesota Ghost Box, only on Para-X Radio.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for dropping by tonight. We've got a great show going on, and I believe we have back with us Barbara Duncan and Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, hello.
And our guest, Nick Redfern.
Yep.
Yep, he's still here. We haven't run off yet. One of the people that you wrote about in your book, and I guess he had a lot of information or disinformation, whichever way you might want to look at it, was a man named Caruso. What part did he play in all this? I mean, Corso. Isn't that what it's
called? Oh, Corso, yeah. Well, Philip Corso wrote what is, without doubt, the most controversial book on Roswell ever. It's called The Day After Roswell. And Philip Corso was a lieutenant colonel in the military decades ago. He died in 98 when he was 83. And he claimed that aliens crashed at Roswell and that the technology that was recovered from the crashed UFO was then sort of what it's called back engineered. In other words, we tried to understand and figure out what the technology was, and then replicate it and use it ourselves. And he said that things like the transistor computer components, fiber optics, night vision equipment, he claimed all of this was developed not by us, but by us actually replicating the alien technology. Now, his book, you know, was an extremely controversial one, and again, like Glenn Dennis, the mortician at Roswell, there are people who believe the Corso story and the people who absolutely do not believe the Corso story. So again, you know, it puts us in this complicated position of, well, was he speaking the truth? Was he telling the truth as he saw it, but was he lied to? Or, you know, was he part of a disinformation program to steer people away from something else and down that particular path? And we'll probably never know. I mean, you know, there are certain motivations that wouldn't have been behind them. I mean, you know, a lot of people think if you write a book, you know, you're sort of living in Beverly Hills driving a Ferrari. You know, it's not like that. I can tell you that for sure. You know, if you want to earn, you know, live in the hills and drive a Ferrari, don't be an author of UFO books. But if you want to enjoy, do something you enjoy, that's what I do, you know. But so, you know, there's little doubt that money wouldn't have been his motivation. So either, you know, there's really two concepts. One is that he told the truth and he wanted to get the facts out, or he was engaging in an ongoing program to confuse the truth of what happened at Roswell, and something happened that wasn't extraterrestrial, but he was sort of ordered, if you like, to follow the, you know, the alien angle, and to promote it. And even 20 years this year after his book came out, people are still debating as to whether or not his book, you know, told the truth, or if it was, again, like some sort of disinformation thing to hide what really happened. So, you know, it's an interesting book to read if you do it, you know, with an open mind and look at the different ideas as to what may have prompted him to, you know, to actually write it.
Well, that's kind of a 2001 thing, isn't it? The Renaissance was an explosion of ideas and science, and it seems to me that this is another sort of a technological Renaissance, but certainly doesn't have to be alien-induced.
Well, yeah, I mean, we know that, I mean, we can prove that night vision equipment was actually being developed before Roswell, and also, you know, that the transistor was being developed before, you know, Corso claimed that we basically developed this technology post-47. You know, transistors were being worked on before 47. But then, he said, well, maybe we just kind of, it helped boost the programs we already had in place. So, you know, that was kind of like, you know, pushing things further, you know, into controversy. But, you know, the whole story that he tells is, it's so precise that it can only be one of two things. It's either literal truth or it's a literal lie. You know, that there's no, because it's so specific, there's no room for, like, there's no vague theories or anything like that in the book at all. It's either you believe it 100% or you're forced to disbelieve it 100%. Yeah.
So what is Unit 731?
Oh, well, Unit 731 was, you know, we mentioned earlier the Japanese balloons. Well, the Japanese balloon program, the plan was, had they not surrendered, you know, in 1945, they had these plans to build these gigantic balloons, which would be sent over to the United States and essentially to attack them. And the plans that the Japanese had, very dangerous plans, were to essentially fill these balloons with insects which would be infected by plague. So when the balloons came down, their plan was to, it would spread, you know, plague across the United States and, you know, kill who knows how many people and farm animals and things like that. And Unit 731 was this sort of biological research lab that was looking to, you know, essentially turn insects into weapons, you know, by infecting them with various diseases that could affect us as well. And so Unit 731 was also looking into the effects of high altitude exposure on people, which reportedly was going on in New Mexico as well. It was going on in New Mexico at the same time. So when the war ended, a lot of the Unit 731 scientists and all their paperwork was brought over to the United States. Now, it's interesting that the guy who oversaw the transfer of all these high altitude files, etc., from Unit 731 was a man named Major General Charles Willoughby. And Major General Charles Willoughby just happened to be one of the closest friends of Philip Corso, and the two of them actually worked together. So, you know, you can put a case together that Corso was protecting Willoughby's program to bring all the Japanese material over here. You know, so you can look at it from that perspective, that he was, that Corso was knowingly, you know, hiding something to protect Willoughby and to keep the whole Japanese angle of all this hidden. So in other words, there's a lot of strands and angles to this story that we'll probably never, you know, get to the bottom of unless, you know, something, like I said, it really gets released that, you know, is so definitive.
Well, you have one of the things in the book with information is you had a treasure trove of files, and it was with Kathy Kasten.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Kathy was a UFO researcher who died in 2012, and she had been following this angle of, you know, could Roswell have been not a UFO, but like a secret military experiment? She'd been following this since the mid-2000s, sort of about 2001, 2002, 2005, that kind of period. And she contacted me when I first wrote about this particular story back in 2005 in an earlier book called Body Snatchers in the Desert. And she contacted me to say that, hey, you know, I've been covering the same kind of areas as you have. And so we became friends and chatted, and, you know, she would exchange material and sent me actually quite a lot of material that was kind of almost eerily similar to the stuff that I got from my sources, but she got other sources. And when she died, because her family knew that, you know, we were friends and we'd researching the same thing and sharing files, they sort of very generously sent me all her records. It was literally thousands of pages of material after she died. And when I went through them, there was a great deal in there about sort of human experiments, high altitude flights in New Mexico, and guinea pig crews, that kind of thing, and, you know, cover-ups, etc. And you know, I find it kind of fascinating because her, like I said, her sources when I read this material were separate sources to the ones I got, and in her files there are mentions of other people as well that she was talking to at the time of her death. And you know, had she not died, she probably would have still been chasing it down now. So that was an important part of the story, was to sort of inherit these files that Kathy had been putting together from round about sort of 2001, 2002, when it sort of really kind of took off for her.
Wow. And one of the things that I guess leading to speculation that it wasn't actually a UFO was there were some other things that come with this. One was about it was like a post-war experiment with humans.
Well, yeah, that kind of gets to sort of the thrust of it, the idea of using human guinea pigs, if you like, to try and understand, you know, what would happen when we start to get into space or close to space. Now, like I said earlier, when you're using animals, which is, you know, it's not nice for the animals, obviously, but also you're not going to get comparative information that kind of ties in with how a person would be affected, you know. But the story that I got and that Kathy got and other researchers like Keith Basterfield, an Australian researcher, who was also given the same story as me, but from other sources, they all said that the time came when people working on this program said, well, if we want to understand how people are going to be affected by exposure to high altitudes, to the stratosphere, to the highest levels of the atmosphere, we're not going to get, you know, actually clear images of what's going on by using monkeys or anything like that. So that they said the time came when the line had to be crossed and they required people to take part in these secret experiments. And, you know, it was a case of, well, you know, they're either going to survive or they're not going to survive, but we'll have an understanding of how they were affected. And so that's sort of the other angle to this, the idea that eventually people were used in these experiments to try and figure out what the result would be, rather than just like monkeys strapped into, you know, the rockets themselves. Now, of course, if that was the case, and, you know, you require space as a minimum again, so you you require sort of relatively short guys, sort of 5 feet tall, because there's not that much room in these craft. One comes down, it crashes, you know, the body's out in the desert for a couple of days. The rancher gets there before the military get there. And you have a crashed UFO legend. Or, you know, people have asked me, you know, is it possible that the story told to me about the Hoover experiments is actually a cover to hide the fact that aliens really did crash? And, you know, if I'm honest, I cannot dismiss that as a possibility. You know, I don't think all the old timers I spoke to were lying or disinforming me. I don't think they were disinforming Keith Basterfield or Kathy Kasten. But in all honesty, if you know, somebody wants me to make a definitive statement, I cannot say for sure I wasn't disinformed and lied to. And maybe aliens really did crash. But that's the problem with Roswell, is that there's no firm, solid answer. There's lots of theories. There's conflicting testimony. And that's about it. And, you know, we're trying to make sense of it when it all occurred, you know, almost three quarters of a century ago, you know. I mean, so you look at it from all those angles, it's no wonder, really, that we haven't solved it, you know, not just for the age, but because of, you know, there's so many different approaches you can take with Roswell.
Well, if there was really a crash and the government has been successful in disinformation and actually hiding the truth, yeah, it would make it very hard to prove it one way or the other.
Yeah, and I think only the people who are sitting on the truth can really know what happened. But they're not saying anything, you know, they're not revealing anything, not revealing any documents, nobody's coming forward. And that's the problem, you know. That I actually do fully believe that some, even if a lot of the files are destroyed, I do believe there are people who know what happened. You know, whether it was ours, theirs, Russian, who knows what it was, but somebody knows. Now, of course, whether or not we'll know, that is down to them. You know, it's not down to us. We have no way of accessing that material at all. So it would be down to them to reveal it. But the big question is, what would motivate them to release it, to reveal it? You know, it's like it would cause them more and more headaches to tell us. From their perspective, it would be much better for them just to say nothing and, you know, be done with it, you know, and just, you know, just hidden away. But maybe there's some people on the inside that do want the story out. You know, perhaps there's like kind of like a silent battle going on in the background where one agency wants the information out, another one wants it kept hidden. So there could still be, you know, light at the end of the tunnel to where one day it could surface. You know, it could happen tomorrow. We could wake up tomorrow and find that somebody has revealed, you know, revealed all the Roswell files. That kind of thing could happen, you know. In today's world, it's unpredictable. So I don't rule out that could actually happen.
That would be headlines for sure, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. It'd be headlines everywhere for the next, I don't know how long, years, never mind year.
You also had a part in there about Dr. Mengele, who was a Nazi. What all did he have to do with it?
Well, that's a good question. It depends on who you ask. A woman named Annie Jacobson wrote a book in 2010 called Area 51, and it was a study of Area 51, its history. And she said that, she spoke to an elderly guy who worked at a connection to Area 51, and he claimed that what came down was a Soviet device, and that the Russians, in conjunction with an absolute total insane German scientist named Josef Mengele, essentially created Mengele didn't create the craft, but the Germans created this craft, which was inherited by the Russians, and that the crew on board, the bodies, were sort of grossly mutilated and altered regular people undertaken by Josef Mengele. Now, Josef Mengele was a real guy. He was a Nazi scientist. Well, if I call him a scientist, like, that's sort of insulting scientist. He was like a crazy...
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, he was like a crazy, sadistic guy who... He had this weird obsession with people who had various, like, dwarfish conditions, you know, sort of short stature, etc. And he also was obsessed with twins and trying to alter the color of people's eyes. You know, the Nazis, they had this nutty idea that everybody had to be sort of blonde-haired and blue-eyed, you know, the so-called master race, as they called themselves, which, of course, we know now, they were not the master race, thankfully, you know, we beat them. But Mengele was obsessed with trying to change the colour of the eyes of people to blue, you know, to be the so-called master race. And I said he was also obsessed with dwarfism, you know, people who had various dwarfish conditions. And so the theory that was told to Annie Jacobson was that the bodies were actually the results of these experiments done by Josef Mengele, and that the bodies looked different than normal because he'd been tinkering around with their eyes and their heads. And it's an interesting story, but to me it's a little bit beyond belief. And now I should stress I don't believe Annie Jacobson was lying or exaggerating at all. I think she told the story exactly as it was told to her. But that doesn't mean that her source hadn't been disinformed by somebody else to hide what happened at Roswell. And that's one of the things a lot of people often don't think about, that when somebody comes from the government, like a whistleblower, to reveal what they knew, they may actually have been given a fake story, and they unknowingly put out a fake story, but thinking it's real, just to hide the truth even more. So I think Annie Jacobson really did tell the story as it was told to her, but whether or not her source was given a real story, even though he believed it, you know, he may actually have been a victim also of a fake story.
Well, I have heard rumors that the concept of UFOs and aliens is a disinformation story that the government has put out to hide something bigger.
Well, personally, I think it's a bit of both, because it's like with my dad's encounter that I mentioned at the beginning, you know, I think we got two things going on. Even though I'm not sure what happened at Roswell, I am sort of like a full-on believer that UFOs are real.
Oh, yeah.
So I think what we've got our UFOs and we've got, quote, their UFOs, you know, and I think there is a real UFO phenomenon. But the problem is that the more and more that our technology develops, the more and more difficult it's going to be to try and figure out what's a real UFO and what might be something that we're flying around. I mean, you look, everybody today knows about drones. Everybody knows what a drone looks like. If you were to see a drone when they were being their prototype test phases, say 15 years ago, and you happened to sort of walk out the door and you saw one of these flying over at a height of maybe 80 feet, 90 feet, you might think you were seeing a UFO. But today we know different. They're drones. So, you know, I think our technology, as it advances and it gets weirder looking, we're not going to be sure what is a genuine UFO and what is, you know, the latest secret device of the military. And so I think those are important things to remember. I think, like I said, there's our UFOs and there's somebody else's UFOs from somewhere else. And when the two kind of combine, because, you know, we're catching up with their technology maybe, then it is going to become, you know, tough to know what's what.
Wow. Barbara, I've hogged everything from you and Jeff.
No.
You guys got some questions.
I know, that's surprising.
I jumped in there quite a few times.
Well, I was going to say, as drones began becoming more common, my brother, who is a videographer back east, got one. And of course, you get the classic trouble that the first generation of drones are amazingly expensive. And now what used to be that high a price is now major professional stuff. Because I go to a trade show once a year where they have different stuff on cameras and stuff. It's just over at Paramount Studios down the block from me. And the drones they have now are massive. I mean, they're like 3 to 4 feet across, some of them. And my brother has one that's like maybe two feet across as a square with the four rotors. And of course, he spent a lot of money on that because it was still early in the technology. And now almost at that same price, you would get one of these mega drones that you can almost carry instead of just a little GoPro camera, like a big camera. So they're becoming more. And of course, now you've got Amazon that's going to be trying to work on delivery at home with drones and stuff like that. So we're going to be seeing a lot of those.
I kind of wonder how Amazon's going to manage that. I mean, the amount of orders they send out every day, and, you know, there's going to be tens of thousands of drones, you know, swooping over people's doorways. And I'm waiting for, like, when somebody opens their front door and gets too close and, you know, the blade takes the head off or something. You know what I mean?
Well, no, they're actually, the blades themselves are encircled, so you would have to stick your hand in it, and that would, like, if you were trying to catch it or something.
Some idiot would probably try and do that.
But I picture landing on people.
We're going to have duck season, rabbit season, drone season.
Exactly.
Probably.
my own personal suspicion is it's going to start leaving packages on people's roofs.
Yeah, right? And then of course somebody's going to have to climb on the roof then, which is going to make it even more difficult. So, but I think, you know, who knows what the future is going to bring, but I think certain aspects, you know, drones, it might not be feasible, but there's no doubt, you know, from a surveillance perspective, they're the perfect thing, you know, and also from the public's perspective, they could turn out to be a nightmare where you're constantly watched by these spies in the skies, you know, when you've done nothing. It's one thing to chase down, you know, the bad guys or whatever, but you know, when it comes to just surveillance of the population, which is increasing, then that's not a good thing. You know, if you've done nothing wrong, you shouldn't be watched. It's that simple.
Exactly. I mean, the Big Brother aspect is always the real terrifying thing, because all technology, all the government does is, how can we exploit this to keep our power?
Well, you know, I mean, technology is always used for what it's meant to be used, but then somebody will come up with another reason for it. I mean, it's like atomic power. You know, atomic power can be really good when it's used in the right way, but when it's turned into an atomic bomb, then it's not a good way.
Right.
So, that's like any kind of technology, really. You know, it's like, that's just down to the human race. We're really good at creating things, and we're really good at destroying things as well.
Yeah, they ruin everything. Yeah, people just can't live for what's good for the people. They want to tear everything up.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we're the only animal on the planet that actually kills each other for anything other than food, you know. I mean, nature's quite harsh, you know, but animals eat animals because to live, you know. We don't, we do it for to gain land and power and whatever. We're the only creature that does that, really.
Now, one of the other things that brought a light or a lot of information, to the story, to your book, was a place called Fort Stanton.
Well, Fort Stanton is an interesting place. If I was to sort of say to you, it's within a stone's throw of the ranch where the wreckage is found, I really would barely be exaggerating. I mean, it's literally kind of down the road from where the crash site was. Now, Fort Stanton has an interesting background because in Kathy Caston's files, she talks about how a source had told her that when the Roswell craft came down, that there were either four or five people on board. Four of them were killed, and there was one survivor. And she was told that the bodies of the four that were killed were taken to the Roswell base, and there was like a quick attempt to try and preserve them, which, you know, is in line with a lot of other people who heard this story as well. You know, they tried to, preserve them from decaying anymore. But she was also told that there was one survivor, a critically injured survivor, and he was supposedly taken to Fort Stanton, which, as I said, is literally no distance from the crash site. And interestingly enough, during the Second World War, Fort Stanton served as a detention center for Japanese people while the war was going on, while we were fighting the Germans and the Japanese. And so, you know, Kathy made a connection there, and according to her source, the one survivor was taken to Fort Stanton but died shortly afterwards. And it's a fascinating little angle to the story that hasn't really been followed up that much, even by me or Kathy. It's they're just sort of snippets of data suggesting there was this... that something came down, there was a survivor taken to Fort Stanton, and to try and figure out, by the damage done to the person's body, exactly what had happened, how this explosion high in the sky had occurred and what trajectory and speed the craft hit the ground. They were trying to figure that out from looking at the injuries to the people on board. So, Fort Stanton now is becoming more and more of a target of Roswell researchers to try and figure out if there is, a legitimate connection and exactly how far it goes.
Well, who was William R. Lovelace II? I know he was like a Roswell player, but what did he do?
Well, he actually comes into play in the Fort Stanton story. William Lovelace was an expert and scientist in the field of high-altitude exposure, and he actually became a major figure within NASA. He was actually killed in a plane crash in 1965, but up until then, he was at the forefront of doing research into the high-altitude exposure and how astronauts, could potentially be injured or, damaged from radiation in space, that kind of thing. But back in 1947, his facility into things like high altitude exposure was based in Albuquerque. And of course, Albuquerque is not that far from Roswell and not that far from the crash site. And according to Kathy Caston's sources, Lovelace was quickly brought into Fort Stanton, essentially ordered, we need your help, your expertise. And he reportedly, was driven by the military to Fort Stanton and to find out what had happened to this man, this guinea pig on the flight, and how he'd become injured, what did the damage to his body suggest had happened. And Lovelace reportedly was there for 3 or 4 days after which the man died. But he, by all accounts, he studied particularly the man's spinal cord, to see the stress on his spinal cord, and again to try and figure out how this had impacted upon what actually happened and how. But Lovelace is actually someone who occasionally pops up in the Roswell research field, and certainly with Kathy Caston's work about Fort Stanton and him being taken to Fort Stanton to check out on the survivor. That's sort of a new angle to it, but it suggests, you know, there's much more to Randall Lovelace beyond what we know right now. And I think, you know, hopefully the mention of it will push more and more people to sort of find out what he was doing and where he was in the summer of 47 and how he was tied into all this. And things like this, you know, may open things up. I mean, I have no proof of this, but it wouldn't surprise me if people like Lovelace, who were brought in to, you know, look into the issue of how the crew were killed, etc., maybe they kept, you know, private little diaries and journals. And so, in other words, even if the government files are gone, it could well be that, you know, there are things like journals and diaries, dusty old diaries sitting in somebody's drawer from 70, 80 years ago, whatever, 60 years ago, just waiting to be read, you know. I think that could actually kind of open things as well, really.
Barbara, I know you've got some questions.
Well, you know, in listening to this, it's almost sounding more like a cover-up for other things. And when there are so many other crashes out there which the government isn't hiding, and at some point, you know, if Elon Musk gets his way, then there's going to be these stratosphere jets that will take people as close as into outer space as you can get without actually going into outer space. People are going to find out about extraterrestrials, UFOs anyway. What is it about Roswell that for some reason they just all clam up? It does sound more like a disinformation tactic.
Well, I think the main reason for the silence, it's either one or two things. The silence either exists because we really do have a crashed UFO and a bunch of dead alien bodies that have been stored away for 70 years, you know, in preservation, or it was a secret experiment that was kind of controversial and nobody wants to talk about it. So I think that's the reason for the silence. It's one of those two angles. And I don't really think there's room for any other angle. It has to be one of them. But, of course, the big question is, you know, me trying to be impartial and, you know, I don't think it's right for me to say it was definitely this or that. If I'm being honest, I cannot prove it wasn't a secret experiment any more than I can prove it was alien. So, you know, I think by being honest and saying to people, I don't, you know, we don't have the full answer, but we need to keep digging. I think that's what we need to do. But I think the reason for the silence has to be either, like I said, it was a UFO and somebody doesn't want to tell us, or it was so controversial an experiment that they don't want to reveal that either, you know. Which one it is, hopefully one day, you know, we'll find out. But it's going to need something that prizes open the doors to Roswell in a way that we're not there yet, you know. We're kind of just at that. We're constantly right now, because of the age of the case and everybody dying off, that we are really like a brick wall. And, you know, I just honestly don't know how we get past that brick wall. I just don't know how we do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like the information that came out this weekend, the sudden photo of what appears to be Amelia Earhart and her navigator.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's forensically impossible to prove any of this, but it's just enough information that keeps these stories going.
Well, yeah, that's an important. That's kind of an important parallel you bring up, because, you know, people think that the Amelia Earhart story, well, you know, where can we take it any further? We can't take it any further. And then suddenly something pops up which shows we actually can take it further. So, despite the best efforts of whoever's hiding the truth of Roswell, something actually could happen that is beyond their, you know, thinking they've got it all covered up or hidden. Like I said, if some old guy who was out at the crash site, you know, took part in the recovery of the wreckage and the bodies, he may have gotten back home, told his wife, and then spent the next 3 hours writing it all up in a little journal. She might still have that journal, you know, locked away in a dresser, you know, in some little home in Arizona or something now, just waiting for the day, you know, when she decides to reveal it or whatever. So I think it is. I think if Roswell's going to surface the truth, it's going to be kind of like that Amelia Earhart story. It's going to be like an alternative, unforeseen way. I don't think it's going to come by disclosure, but it could come in a way that nobody is expecting it to come.
Quick question about the people. If it was an experiment, a human experiment, then there has to be humans who survived those experiments. Has there been anybody coming forward? Has there been any, even a hint of, oh yeah, I went up one day in a weather balloon and told my grandkids all about it? Sort of.
Well, the only time that's happened is the acknowledged experiments, which were sort of in the 50s onwards. But I mean, you know, that's a matter of official record when pilots, you know, would go up and, you know, to the highest levels and experiments would be undertaken. But what we're talking about in the 40s, pretty much, are sort of using people against their will. You know, guinea pigs, people from hospitals, prisons, asylums, and just, you know, using them in guinea pig formats. So in those situations, nobody has spoken out. You know, if the story's not true, if it's disinformation, then obviously they wouldn't talk about it. If it's true, then they may have been, you know, as I talk about in the book, there's some evidence that some of these people may have been given a deal, you know, in terms of, you survive this, you know, we'll make it worth your while, that kind of thing, on providing you remain silent. So, you know, but again, even if there were people who were thinking about talking about it, you know, with it being so long ago, like I said, almost everybody is gone. I mean, there is, even the ones who are around aren't even the first-hand witnesses. You know, the first-hand witnesses are gone. What we've got now are the families of the first-hand witnesses who told them what they saw. So, you know, it is really getting difficult now to, you know, answer a lot of these questions and figure out what really happened, you know, and the time frame and everything else.
Well, our time has just flown right on by. 2 hours.
We've got missing time.
And we want to thank you for taking time to actually spend with us tonight going over this book.
Oh, well, thanks, guys.
And I'm going to let you give out all your information of how people can follow you and where they can get your books and everything. And then we want you to stay on for a minute till after we're off, and we'll talk with you for a minute.
All right. Well, people can reach me. I've got a Twitter account, Nick Redfern UFO. You can find me on Facebook. If you search Nick Redfern, there are, like, I think 7 or 8 Nick Redferns. But if you scroll through, you'll see me with, I think, current pictures, like sunglasses, bandana, and about 5 or 6 earrings and whatever. You know. And so that's me anyway. And as far as my books are concerned, well, the new one's called The Roswell UFO Conspiracy, and you can find it on Amazon. And for people who still like to go into bookshops, you can order it over the counter in Barnes & Noble as well. So.
All right.
And if you can find a Barnes & Noble, let me know where it is. Oh, wait.
Jeff?
Yes, well, you can go to our official website, theparanormalview.com. We're also on Facebook, so it's facebook.com/theparanormalview. I post articles throughout the week, as well as links to report pages like tonight, so that you can go right to facebook.com/nick.redfern.73, his Twitter account, all of his website and his podcast, his YouTube channel, and even Wikipedia. He and I are both on Wikipedia. So, great. Everybody stay cool.
All right. Barbara?
Just that tonight is an absolute delight, and it's the first show that Jeff has not mentioned Doctor Who.
But because the season finale was last week. I thought you were going to talk about the beautiful full moon we had out tonight. Or last night.
Yeah, it's tonight. Yeah. In a couple of hours.
I haven't been able to get out to see it yet, though. I'll have
You know there's a huge solar eclipse in August, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So with that, though, I want to remind everybody about the Para-X Fort Mifflin event is September 16th. there'll be more coming out about that. So you can follow us, and we'll give you all the information as we get it. I know I will be there, and there's lots of other people from Parex that in and out, and some of the hosts of the shows is going to be there. It's going to be a great, great little thing. So it's $45. Come get your tickets, and I think you can go to the site at Fort Mifflin, and they may have it up already. I'm not sure that you can get tickets online. So with that, we are out of time. This is Henry Foister,
Jeffrey Gould,
and Barbara Duncan.
And we will see you next week at the same time. So good night, everybody. You've been listening to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. Join us again next week at the same time for more of The Paranormal View.